Now, 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 14. 1 Corinthians 10, 14. Idle feasts and the Lord's Supper is what we're going to title this morning's talk. While waiting for his train, a man was with the station master. They were on the side of a station, and an express train that wasn't due to stop at that station went zooming by. And you know what it's like when you've been standing at a station and a train goes by. You feel the breeze, the power of the wind that it creates, and the noise it makes goes by, and everything seems to rattle. The power of a train zooming by. And the man said to the station master, "Wow, what a powerful train. What a powerful train." And the station master said, "Yes, it is, but when it comes off the rails, it is as weak as anything. When it comes off its rails, it is as weak as anything." And of course, the Christian life is very much like that. While we keep on the rails, we experience the power of God in our lives. We can live the sort of lives that please God. But if we get derailed, if we allow things to come in and to derail us, we are as weak as anyone. And we fall back into bad habits and to wrong lifestyles. And the Apostle Paul knows in this chapter there are certain things that will derail these Christians in Corinth. One of those key things is idolatry. Idolatry. And so he writes to them to keep them on the track, to keep them on the straight and narrow, so that they're not derailed. We're going to split it into three parts this morning. First of all, verse 14, he gives a command. Verse 14, "Therefore, my dear friends, flee from idolatry." Flee from idolatry. Some things are always wrong and should always be avoided. Idolatry has always been a problem to God's people. It was a problem all the way through the Old Testament, again and again and again. Even when Moses came down the mountain with the Ten Commandments, what did he find the people doing? Worshipping a golden calf. And they never learnt. Even though God allowed their enemies to take them over as a kind of discipline and punishment, they never learnt until they were taken up into captivity. And when they returned from Babylon, they never went back to idolatry. But it took that to get it into God's people. Don't worship false gods. And for God's people in the New Testament, idolatry was a big problem, especially for the Corinthians. Dominating the city at Corinth, on the hill of the Acropolis, 1,500 feet high, was a temple. A temple of Aphrodite. That was the Aphrodite is the Greek name. The Roman name was Venus, the goddess of love. And this huge temple dominated the city. You couldn't help but notice it. And its influence permeated the whole of society. It was an impressive building. And if you wouldn't go to the temple, well, the temple would come to you every night. 1,000 male and female priestesses would leave the temple and come down into the city to ply their trade. And I say ply their trade, it wasn't to practice their religion as such. They were prostitutes. And Venus, the god of love, would come down. And you can imagine the immorality of 1,000 male and 1,000 female prostitutes in the city at night. So the influence of the temple was everywhere. There was a religious attraction. If you wanted to worship God, you worship via the temple. There was a social attraction. It was the hub of community life. If you weren't at the temple, you didn't know what was happening. And there was a sexual attraction. It appealed to the baseness of men and women. Now, most of us will not bow down to a statue of wood or stone. But the idols that we allow into our life are just as real, but perhaps a little more subtle. Someone has said this: idolatry is allowing anything to come between you and God. Idolatry is anything that you allow to come between you and God. And we might not have visible idols like they did at Corinth, but we face a whole pressure, a pantheon of false values. Materialism dominates our society, doesn't it? Got to get more money. The love of leisure sensuality, worship of self, and many more. Someone has said this: today our idols are more in the self than off the shelf. At Corinth, you went into a shop and off the shelf you picked up your idols. You took them home, you worshipped them. But our idols are more in the self. Materialism, leisure, sensuality, relationships. We allow so many things to come in between us and our relationship with God. And just like a physical idol, they will derail us. And we will lose our power in following Jesus. Now in verse 14, there's a link. Therefore. And of course, the old principle is whenever you read the word therefore, you stop and you say, what's it there for? And it's linking back to what you heard last week when Rob Milligan was preaching. Therefore, my dear friends, there's affection here. He's not like a policeman after a nasty criminal. He's not like a headmaster with a naughty school children. He's like a loving father, a spiritual brother. My dear friends, you're not just friends, you're dear to me. This is breaking my heart, because it breaks the heart of God. Flee from idolatry. I don't think he's concerned these Christians are going to go back, buy an idol off the shelf and bow down to it again. I think he's concerned that by going back into the temple, by going back to the guilds, the business functions that are held in the temple in a religious setting, they're going to start to compromise and give on this and give on that. And sooner or later, before they know it, idolatry is back into their lives. It's influencing their way they think and the way they behave. Therefore, flee idolatry. And the therefore, as we'll see in a minute, links back to what we heard last week. You see, for these Corinthians, the temple promised so much and it delivered so little. On the Caribbean island of Barbados is a castle. It belonged to a man called Sam Lord. You can still go there today and see the castle, the ruins. Sam Lord was a cunning and a crafty pirate, because he didn't use a ship. Now you might say, can you be a pirate without a ship? Yes, you can. And this is what he did. At night, he would get his crew to light lanterns, and they would hang them from the trees along the shoreline. And when a ship came on the water at night, looking for the town of Bridgetown, it saw all the lanterns, all the lights, and it assumed it had arrived. And so the ship would turn into the light, and as they got close to the coastline, the coral reef would tear out the bottom of the boat. And the ship would start to sink. And Sam Lord and his men would row out to the boat. They would kill the survivors. And they would rob them of any treasure, of any plunder. The alluring lights, they offered so much to the sailors. We've arrived. We're safe. Home. We can get refreshment. We can get drink. We can relax. It promised so much. And it delivered so little. So does idolatry, so does the world. It attracts us in, it promises so much, but actually it tears away the important things in our lives. So the apostle gives a command: flee idolatry. Those things that come in between you and God and spoil that relationship, run away from them, get rid of them. And as I mentioned, the word therefore links it back to last week. There were two groups last week. In verse 12, there were the self-confident Christians. And Paul says to them, so if you think you're standing firm, that's good, but it's not good enough. Be careful, lest you fall. And in every church, there's always Christians who are doing well. Well done, you get a pat on the back. But if you go out this building thinking, I'm set up for the week ahead, in your own strength, you're going to fail. You ain't going to do it, folks. So Paul said, if you're self-confident, stand firm, but be careful. The temptations are out there. And pride always comes before a fall. So if you don't keep close to God, you're going to be derailed. The second group in verse 13 he talks to are the discouraged. Those who felt overwhelmed, overcome by temptation. Some of us are a bit like the psalmist. We wake up in the morning and we look at our lives and think, wow, my sins are more than the hairs on my head. And some of you are thinking, well, you haven't got many, have you? Hairs on your head. I might not, but I've got plenty of sin, and so have you. And so he gives a word to those who struggle, who find temptation everywhere. And he tells them that your struggles are not unique to you. No temptation has overtaken you, except what is common to man. Every Christian struggles. They might not admit it, they might not show it, but we all have those inward battles. But look what he says, God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way so that you can endure it. When the temptation comes, the prayer to pray is, Lord, show me that way of escape. Show me that way of escape. I like the old joke about a man who goes to the doctor. It's a kind of a Tommy Cooper type joke. He goes to the doctor and he said, Doctor, I've broken my arm in two places. And the doctor says, well, don't go to those two places then. Well, you might have a giggle, but I think the doctor's got something. If there are certain places you go and you're going to face major temptations you can't handle, don't go to those places. Stay out of them. And that's what the apostle is saying to these Christians at Corinth. I know your culture is pulling you back into the temple. And you might not bow down to an idol. But if you're not careful, you're going to be in the wrong places. And you leave yourself open to the wrong influences. So that's the command. At every opportunity, flee idolatry. The second thing he says is this. He gives them three reasons why they should flee idolatry. Three reasons why. Number one, association with idolatry leads to participation with idolatry. That's verses 16 to 18. He uses three illustrations, and from his three points, and he uses two illustrations here. One about communion, the Lord's Supper, and one about the Old Testament, making sacrifices. Let's read verse 16. Is not the cup of thanksgiving for which we give thanks our participation in the blood of Christ? And is not the bread that we break our participation in the body of Christ? Because there is one loaf, we who are many are one body, for we all share one loaf. Consider the people of Israel. Do not those who eat the sacrifices participate in the altar? So in those two verses, he gives two illustrations. One to do with communion, one to do with Old Testament sacrifices. And the key word, it's repeated three times in one form or another. Sharing participation. Sharing participation. It's there twice in verse 16 and once in verse 17. And he says, by taking communion, you are not an observer looking on. You're a participator sharing in. So when we take communion, we're not onlookers, we're participators. And notice, we call it communion. And the emphasis in the word communion isn't communion with God. It's communion with one another. We are one body, one family. We are sharing together. Nobody takes communion in isolation. We do it as the family of God, as the church of God, as the body of God. So the whole point is here, when you take communion, and the same happened in the Old Testament, when you took your offering, it was a participatory, a sharing experience. Now follow the logic here. He says in verse 16 and 17, if God's behind communion, and God was behind the Old Testament sacrifices, when you go and share in the temple, full of idolatry, who's behind that? Not the true and living God. Satan is behind the idolatrous sacrifices of pagan religion. So don't have anything to do with them. Flee them. Get away from them. So his first point, association with idolatry will lead to participation with idolatry. His second reason to flee idolatry, participation in idolatry leads to involvement with the devil. That's verses 19 and 20. Participation in idolatry leads to involvement with the devil. Look at verse 19. Do I mean then that food sacrificed to an idol is anything, or that an idol is anything? No. But the sacrifices of pagans are offered to demons, not to God. And I do not want you to be participants with demons. We looked at this in chapter 8 a few weeks ago, and it's kind of refreshing their memories. An idol is just made of stone or wood, but there's nothing to it. Meat offered to an idol, because the idol is just wood or stone, it's got no reality to it, it's just meat. Paul emphasises a key truth. Let me quote verse 19 in J.B. Phillips' paraphrase. Am I implying that a false god really exists? Or that sacrifices made to any god have some value? Not at all. Not at all. But now he adds something new to the argument here in verse 20. Although an idol is just wood and stone, nothing else, it's not living, it has eyes that can't see, a nose that can smell, that can't smell, lips that can't speak, it's just a piece of wood or a piece of stone. Now in verse 20, he adds something new to the mixture. Although meat offered to a pagan god is just a lump of meat, here he adds something new. Behind the outward visible act, there is an invisible act taking place of darkness. The sacrifices of pagans are offered to demons, not God. As you get closer and closer to idolatry, and you start to compromise, you leave a foothold for the devil to go into. It's like locking up your house, but leaving the back door open when you go out. We're very good at that in our house, aren't we, Ben? Come home, nice and secure, you walk out and the back door's open. You've given a foothold, an opportunity for the devil to get in. And when we get entrenched in a certain sin, an idol is created. It's come between us and God. And once an idol is carved in our minds, in our behaviour, in our attitudes, we've allowed the evil one to get a foothold in our lives. I like what Paul Rozinski says. I don't play in Satan's playground. If I played in his playground, he would eat my lunch. I don't play in Satan's playground. If I played in his playground, he would eat my lunch. I suppose a more serious one is this. You can't stop birds from flying over your head. Temptation's everywhere. Sin is everywhere. We live in a world gone wrong. I can't stop the birds flying over my head, but I can stop them building nests in my head. That's the difference, isn't it? And that's what Paul is saying here. And then he gives a third reason why they are to flee idolatry. Involvement with the things of the devil leads to spiritual disaster. Verse 21. Involvement with the things of the devil leads to spiritual disaster. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons too. You cannot have part in both the Lord's table and the table of demons. There are some things in life that do not mix. They're oil and water. They're light and darkness. They're chalk and cheese. And any form of idolatry, be it wood, stone, or the modern idols we create, if we don't deal with them, they will keep us away from the Lord, or the Lord will keep us away from them. But you can't have both. Mormon acquaintance once went to Mark Twain. Mark Twain is an American humorist, playwright, but very funny man. In his day, people would queue several times round the block to get in to hear him lecture and talk. He was a very witty and a very wise man. And a Mormon acquaintance had said to Mark Twain that the values of polygamy, having more than one wife, and encouraging him to have more than one wife. And Mark Twain said, no, it's wrong. And his acquaintance said, well, you can't show me anywhere in the Bible where it says you can't have more than one wife. And Mark Twain said, yes, I can. He said, no, you can't. Mark Twain said, yes, I can. Prove it then. So Mark Twain turned him to the words of Jesus, Matthew 6:24. No man can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other. Or else hold up the one and despise the other. Now that's what the Apostle Paul is saying here. Mark Twain did it tongue in cheek, of course. But Jesus said, and Paul said, you can't have both. You either love the Lord and he's your master, or you love something else, and that will dominate your life. But you can't get both at the same time. And look what verse 22 says. God does not like split loyalties. Are we trying to arouse the Lord's jealousy? Are we stronger than he? God does not like split loyalties. He didn't like it in the Old Testament, and he doesn't like it in the New Testament. He is a jealous God. A jealous God. Now, to you and me, the word jealous is an ugly word. Shakespeare put it this way: it is a green-eyed monster. And that's because as human beings, we're sinful creatures, we're tainted, we're flawed. And so when we get jealous, our jealousy comes out in overtones of selfishness, in suspicion, distrust. It is often possessive, demanding, overbearing. It's repulsive. It stifles freedom and individuality. It degrades and it demeans. We view jealousy as a nasty trait, and rightly so. But God isn't flawed like human beings, so his jealousy doesn't come with baggage. God is holy and perfect. His jealousy is different. In fact, in the Old Testament and the New Testament, the word jealousy has got a twin, a Siamese twin, zealous. Jealousy, zealousness. And zealous just means it's a wholesome way of protecting, a wholesome way of loving. And God views us as his children, and he gets jealous when things hurt his children. Just like any parent who sees their child being hurt will intervene and sort it out. God looks at the things we allow into our lives, our idols, that spoil our relationship, and he gets zealous, he gets jealous, because his children are being hurt, and he wants to sort it out. And then the third and the final part of this chapter, he gives a command. He gives three reasons why we're to flee idolatry. And then he reminds us, what is our ultimate objective as believers, as Christians? So verse 23 to verse 1 of chapter 11, he gives us our objective. To summarise it, verse 31. Whether you eat or drink, whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Remember this, we exist for God, God does not exist for us. Got that? We exist for God, we are his creatures. God does not exist for us, we exist for God. The old Westminster Shorter Catechism, a series of question and answers, a way of teaching people their theology in past generations. The very first question is this: what is the chief end of man? Why have you been put on planet Earth? And the answer, man's chief end, to glorify God, to enjoy him forever. That's why you were born, to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. Everything needs a purpose. A bridge has a purpose. It allows people or transport to get from one side to the other. A telescope has a purpose. It allows things that are very far away to be brought very close. Everything has a purpose, and people need a purpose, and your purpose and my purpose is to know God, to enjoy God, to serve God, and to worship God. All summarised in that one word, to glorify God, to glorify God. But we live in a world where lots of people don't know that. In Alice in Wonderland, the conversation takes place. Alice and the Cheshire Cat are talking, and Alice says to the cat, "Would you tell me, please, which way I ought to go from here?" And the cat replies, "Well, that depends a good deal on where you want to get to." Alice responds, "Well, I don't much care where." So the cat says, "Then it doesn't really matter where you go." We live in a world, don't we, where a lot of people don't care about glorifying God, so it doesn't matter how they live their lives. But as Christians, we're different. We have a purpose. We're going in a certain direction. Now, to help these Christians glorify God, Paul just answers two more questions. It's a cultural problem for them. The first question is verse 25. What about meat in the marketplace? Remember from chapter 8, if you wanted a good steak, if you wanted a nice leg of lamb for your Sunday dinner, the best market to go was next to the temple. Why? Because when they took sacrifices, they always took the best animals. Part of the animal was burnt at the altar. Part of the animal was consumed by the priest. But the leftover was sold in the marketplace. So all the best meat was in the market next to the temple. So if you wanted good food at a good price, you went to the market. And the Christian says, can we do that? Because it's been offered in idolatrous sacrifice. And Paul says in verse 25, yes, you can. Eat anything sold in the marketplace without raising questions of conscience, for the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. Paul says, look, when it comes to your shopping list, there's no restrictions. You go and buy what's good. If the meat is good, buy it and enjoy it. Don't get so preoccupied that you're looking for reasons not to enjoy it. Just enjoy it. Have a clear conscience. God made everything. He made things to be enjoyed. So go ahead. And then the second question, but what if we're invited to an unbeliever's home? What if we're invited to a meal in the temple? What if we're invited to a meal in the workplace, the guild hall? So we're going from a private issue where Paul says, do whatever you want with a clear conscience, to a public issue. And here he gives different advice. Verse 27. If an unbeliever invites you to a meal and you want to go, eat whatever is put before you without raising questions of conscience. Again, if your host gives you a good meal, enjoy it. Enjoy it. Just one exception, verse 28. Suppose you go, but you've got a new Christian, a younger Christian, a weaker Christian in their faith. And they say to you, hasn't that been offered to idols? Verse 28. Paul says, well, in that case, just say, we won't eat it then. We won't eat it. For the sake of his conscience, not yours, you can eat it with freedom. Let me culturize it, bring it up to date. Suppose you and we're invited out for a meal. And we go there, and our host says, oh, look, here's a nice glass of wine. Would you like one? And I say, oh, I like a glass of red. Yes, please. But you say, not sure I should have a drink. Doesn't the Bible say that alcohol leads to drunkenness? And if I have one drink, maybe I'll have two and I'll get drunk. So I say, well, okay then, if you can't handle it, if it's against your conscience, I won't have one either, I'll just have a Coke. For the sake of you, not because I've got a problem, but if it helps you, let's just have a Coke. And that's what Paul's saying here about me. Enjoy it, it's only a lump of meat. You haven't prayed to a false God, but if someone's conscience is troubled, who's with you, then just say, no, okay, we'll do something else. Just to help them. Just to help them. So, meat offered to idols. It's a difficult passage. Thank you for your concentration this morning. But it does have applications because idols come along in all shapes and sizes. Not off the shelf, but in the self. We have to deal with them. Flee it. He gives us reasons why. And at the end, he just gives some practical applications to the people of Corinth. Let's pray.